Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 75 of the Alabama Liberal Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about, is America headed for civil war? Now, this is an ominous topic to get into. First episode after the first debate, and I think people called it Fight Night in America. I was calling it that before the debate happened. Then during the debate, it was a headache. Trump was a sentient headache. Biden, I could tell, was getting on his nerves, was getting on the moderator's nerves, was getting on everybody's nerves. And then after it was over, I got really scared. We talk about him so much. We say he's crazy, he's incompetent, he's a moron, he's like an 8-year-old. But those things are true. We have a corrupt, incompetent, insane bigot who is prepared to sink the country into a civil war if it means he can stay in office. We say that so much that it's almost like it doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel like something that could actually happen. It feels a little bit abstract. It could happen. Doomsday scenarios about Trump, people say, oh, there's no way he can win the nomination. And then some of the doomsdayers are like, he can win the nomination, exclusively based on illegal immigration and the reaction to that and the fears of the Browning of America. And then he did win it. We said, oh, well, it could go to a contested convention and they could put in somebody different. That didn't happen. We say, well, there's no way Hillary Clinton is going to lose to him, and the Electoral College, the whole reason that was put into place is to keep somebody like him. She wins the popular vote by 3 million people. He wins the Electoral College in a scenario that even surprised him. Michael Moore called it a perp walk when him and his people walked out on stage. They looked like they were at a funeral. They didn't look like they expected to win. I remember in 2012, they said Mitt Romney did not write a concession speech because he was so convinced he was going to win. And then, of course, in 2016, Trump did not write an acceptance speech because he was so convinced he was going to lose. The Electoral College, everybody says, well, there's some hope that they may come in and they might say, well, 3 million people voted for Hillary, more people voted for Hillary, their votes never been this far apart. Of course, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to honor the will of the people. They didn't do that. Then Trump's inaugurated, which we couldn't believe. Then he becomes president. Then we thought, well, surely to God, once he's impeached, maybe he'll say, I'm not going to run again. He runs again. Now we have a scenario where he set up a double game. And I've seen his kids, Eric Trump, do this, where Eric Trump will say, oh, well, of course, if Trump got blown out of the water, he would step down. But then in the next breath, he'll say, if he gets blown out of the water, that means there's been voter fraud. So there's a weird double game. If it goes to one or two states that Biden wins, Trump's going to take it to the Supreme Court. He's going to demand recounts. He's going to take it to the Supreme Court. That Amy Coney Barrett, they're going to let the Supreme Court decide it. But if he gets blown out of the water, then there's voter fraud. So he set up a weird double game where no matter what happens, he's not going anywhere. If he loses the night of the race, he's not going to step down because he says we have to make sure every vote is counted. So it could be several million votes that come in up to a week later. The election is not going to be decided the night of. If you're looking at the stock market, I predict that there'll be we had a really bad dip in March. That's going to happen in November of this year. It could happen a little bit before then. It could happen in October or whatever. But the week of the election and the week after the election, and quite possibly that entire 75-day period between the election and the inauguration in January, we could see some real bad times for finance, the stock market, things like that, because things are about to get really bad. Trump has roughly 75 days to create as much mischief and as much chaos as possible. During the debate, he even said, we don't have to appoint Barrett before the election. We have a lot of time between the election and January, as you know. And he said it that way, as though if he loses, he damn sure is going to try his best to put in the Supreme Court justice. He might be thinking, well, let's hold off until at least the election has pretended to conclude so that way he can ram her through. This really gets kind of scary to me because during the debate, we see a Trump that was asked repeatedly, and everybody's already pointed this out. Most people know this, but he was asked repeatedly to disavow white supremacist groups, far right-wing national groups. He kept going to Antifa, largely a figment of their conservative imagination. They really haven't done anything comparatively to what Republicans credit them for, like starting the West Coast wildfires and different things like that, is mostly bullshit. It's not a group. It's just a loose coalition of people that, hey, I think we'll call ourselves Antifa and wear masks. It's not organized. It's not anything, really, but it's largely in their imagination. But he says things like, well, Antifa, they're the violence, the far left. That's where I see all the violence coming from. That's not even remotely true. After 9/11, far right-wing nationalist groups and white supremacists have committed more terrorist attacks than Muslims. Cesar Sayoc, a Trump supporter, tried to blow up half the Democratic Party in 2018. He sent pipe bombs to everybody from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama to Nancy Pelosi. The Unabomber, far right-wing terrorist. Timothy McVeigh, second biggest terrorist attack on American soil. Timothy McVeigh. The militias, his people. He encourages them during the shutdowns to go to Michigan, go to Virginia, go to these different states that are having shutdowns and protest it. And they show up with their AK-47s, their camouflage vests, clearly trying to intimidate people. We've never seen a Black Lives Matter rally where everybody shows up with Tech-9s and AK-47s. I don't know what would happen if that were to go down. The fact that every major assassination is a left-wing figure, JFK, RFK, MLK, Medgar Evers. Right now in the Arizona Senate race, Mark Kelly's running, and I sure hope he can beat Martha McSally. But his wife, Gabby Giffords, was almost murdered by a Republican gunman that shot her and almost killed her. So it's blatantly not true that liberals are more violent, that the violence is coming from us. Even the riots that we're talking about, these are a reaction to police shootings. This is because people are getting killed by cops with guns and badges, and we have no outlet to fight that. So it's not true that the liberals are the violent ones. Even that Kenosha shooter that they all loved, that guy drove from Illinois to Wisconsin to kill two people. That's the guy who crossed state lines to be involved in the chaos. I guess I just saw the news. I thought it was his store. Like, it was his store that was being burned down, and he had to step in and shoot somebody. That guy drove across state lines to get involved in that shit. Trump's base is inserting themselves into these scenarios, and that's not surprising if you really know, as I know, the conservative mindset. Growing up in Alabama, a lot of people, after 9/11, you would see them be like, talking about like Al-Qaeda was going to come blow up the Abrable-Boaz game, and they're like, we're ready for him, we're ready for him. There's a mentality out there, like this diehard mentality of like, what if we were at Walmart and Al-Qaeda came barging through the doors or something? I would call it a Red Dawn scenario where the Russians invade America, but now I think the Republicans would support that. So it almost becomes like, what if a liberal horde tries to cross the border and then the Minutemen go down on the border and they try to get involved? What if there's a riot going on in Kenosha and a guy drives across state lines to get involved? What if George Zimmerman sees a kid that looks like he could be breaking into a house, and then he winds up starting a fight with him and gets that kid killed? There's a mentality that's mostly based on action movies from the 80s and 90s, the Dirty Harrys, the Die Hards, idea that a civilian just winds up in the wrong place at the wrong time. But of course, to them, it's the right place at the right time. These people are looking for a scenario where they can be heroes, or in their mind, they're heroes. And they don't see that it's kind of like they're the real villains. When you have people showing up at a state house and state capitol to protest a shutdown or face mask or social distancing or whatever it is, and they show up with Confederate flags and rifles and things like that, that sends a very clear message that they're trying to intimidate people. And so Trump tells his base, stand down and stand by. Stand by is important because what he's saying is, I may need to call you to action. Be ready. If November doesn't go the right way, be ready. And that's not surprising, given what he said in the past. The people with the guns are on my side. Now, I talked about in one of the last episodes that they're like, oh, we're so afraid to say that we're for Trump because of cancel culture and they're coming for us. And I pointed out how that was bullshit. They say liberals are snowflakes and wimpy and weak. You know, he has the militias. At the debate, he said over and over, the military is on my side. The police are on my side. You can't name one police union that's on my side. Things like the people with the guns are on my side. Even the bikers. I remember there was a hilarious thing where Curb Your Enthusiasm made fun of Trump and MAGA hat and a biker left him alone. And Trump retweeted it, not realizing that he's making fun of what assholes that MAGA people are. But like that huge Sturgis rally in South Dakota, thousands of motorcycle people went to Sturgis, South Dakota for that motorcycle rally that they all have. They call that a super spreader event. A lot of those people got coronavirus. They come from all over the country on motorbikes, so they're spreading it to every town that they go to. They've called that a super spreader event throughout the Midwest. But he's proud that those people back him. Those people are on his side, right? They like him because he's an alpha male dick, machismo, gonna sock it to the libs and political correctness and all this stuff. So they're kind of backing him on those front. They're backing a tyrant, and they can't see it that way. But that's exactly what they're doing. These people that supposedly love freedoms and small government and the Constitution and libertarianism, they're backing an aspiring tyrant. So when he tells the Proud Boys, stand by for the election, when he refuses to say that he will have a transition of power, they've asked him about the transition of power, he says there will not be a transition of power. He's floated the idea many times that the election is rigged if he loses. He said it in 2016, if I lose, the election's rigged. Then all of a sudden, he won razor-thin margins in three purple states, and Hillary won by 3 million votes, a result that was incredibly suspicious to me. And all of a sudden, everything is normal. it was a good result. It's a good race. I like this. We're going to certify it. And you can almost imagine what would have happened if Hillary had contested the results in 2016. So one of the things she said is Biden should not concede the race if he loses, meaning the night of the race. And I think people are misinterpreting what she's saying. They're taking it like if Biden loses, period, he shouldn't concede. And she's saying he shouldn't concede the night of the race because there's going to be millions of votes that come in up to 7 days after the race. It could take 2 weeks, a month to certify this. It could go longer than the 2000 vote with Gore and Bush. That's what she means. She's trying to say that, but they're taking it like, oh, well, it's a coup for power and all this. I've pointed out, like, well, how come Hillary didn't try harder in 2016 to basically tell the Electoral College? And these are people. The Electoral College is just people. The electors are just individual people. But you go to them and you say, I won by 3 million votes. The will of the people is clear that I am supposed to be president. Trump has the Russians and he has hostile foreign governments. He's all these different things that you could have brought up. You were not designed to keep the will of the people from being expressed. The Electoral College is around specifically to keep somebody like Donald Trump from becoming president. And so it was really against the spirit that was the only mechanism for which he became the president. But you can almost imagine if she had done that, how crazy the country would have went. They're stealing it from Trump. They're stealing it from Trump. The result is that we've had our rights stolen as Democrats over and over again. Republicans say this shit about elections have consequences. That's their big phrase. They say that over and over again. But of course they don't. If they keep losing and then they get to be in charge anyway. In the first 225 years of this nation, the popular vote and the Electoral College, it was only different twice. Only twice that a president lose the popular vote and become president anyway. Now it's happened twice in the last 16 years, 2000 and 2016. Could happen three times this year, which if it does, I think we have to do something at this point because it's just gotten to be too egregious and too out of control. Then you have the fact that the Senate is not democratic at all. And people say, yeah, well, America is supposed to be a republic. That's bullshit. That's another Republican talking point that doesn't convince anybody because we're supposed to be the democracy in the world. We go around spreading democracy all over the planet. We've been looked to, at least since World War II, possibly since World War I, as the light in the world. While the rest of the world crumbles and falls to fascism and communism, America is the democracy, the truth, justice, and the American way. So for us to come out and then be like, oh, well, really, it's okay that nothing here is democratic because we're a republic anyway, that's horseshit. It's ridiculous that the Republicans keep making that point. You basically have a case where the Senate, the Dakotas outvote California 2-1, which is absurd. Democratic senators have had 15 million more votes cast for them than Republican senators. Part of the reason that we're so outraged by the hypocrisy of the Supreme Court nominations, in 2016, Mitch McConnell says, oh, well, the people need a vote for Scalia's replacement. Barack Obama won the popular vote handily in 2012, and the Democratic senators had more votes for them than the Republican majority had cast for them. And there was 8 months left on Obama's term. But then you come to 2020, and you say, oh, well, the will of the people, they must. And even at the debate, Trump was bragging over and over again. He goes, I won 2016. You didn't win. This is the part that fucking kills me. I'm going to emphasize this over and over. When his people say, well, you don't know that he's going to lose because in 2016, the polls were wrong. The polls weren't wrong. He fucking lost. We just didn't account for the insane quirk of the Electoral College that you could lose by 3 million votes and still win. We just didn't think that was possible. Now, we've gotten a lot better at monitoring purple states and red states. His fans keep saying that. They go, yeah, everything you know is wrong because Trump won in 2016. They say that like they fucking won. This is like you're in the Olympics and the person who clearly wins is disqualified for some insane quirk of the rules. And then the silver star person comes out there and says, I won. I'm the best. I'm the baddest. It's so like Trump to lose in a landslide. But because of the insane rule book, he comes out there and brags and brags. It's like he still loses, but he gets to brag that he's like a winner or something. That fucking drives me nuts. But in 2016, okay, well, the will of the people, they have to be accounted for, which was insane. Obama was elected. He had 8 months left. The Senate was no place to block his nomination like that. Now you have it in 2020, where the same people talking about the people deserve a vote and say the elections have consequences. Trump lost in 2016. The majority of the people did not vote for him. Who have the majority of people voted for? Not the Senate. 15 million more people have voted Democratic in the Senate. So again, you have a non-democratically elected Senate and a non-democratically elected president ramming through a justice a month until the election and early voting's already started. But who has been democratically elected? The House of Representatives, who impeached him. a majority of the country has voted for Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats, and they've impeached this bastard. So you have a president who was democratically impeached, not democratically elected, but is going to a non-democratically elected Senate to ram through a SCOTUS judge with 30 days left until the election's over, but has already started an early voting. The hypocrisy is astounding. But if that happens, you have a Senate that the majority of the people did not vote for. You have a president the majority of the people did not vote for, and that's happened twice in the last 20 years. You have 5 out of 9 Supreme Court justices that have been appointed by presidents that did not win the popular vote. And you have a majority of the state governors and state legislatures that are Republican, even though the majority of the country is not with them and hasn't supported them. Look at things like this, and you see the enormous power imbalance that exists at the state level. And it really exists at the state level. Most red states, like Alabama, they do all their voting in midterm elections. The governor and the state legislatures and things like that. If 25% of people actually show up and vote in those that could vote, that's considered high turnout. Then you have the fact that even at the House Democratic level, the Tea Party wave came in at 2010. So that's why the Republicans were allowed to draw the census maps from 2010 to 2020. So they gerrymandered the hell out of it. So in 2012, 2014, and 2016, even though Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats got more votes, John Boehner was still the Speaker of the House, and also Paul Ryan. They were allowed to draw maps. And that's how bad it was. I think House Democrats had 1 million more votes cast for them in 2014 or 2016, I believe. And yet the House Republicans still controlled the House. And that's how bad it's been. Even in the one institution of our government where their majority is supposed to rule, it still didn't. But there's a silver lining in that, because they've said Alabama, the census is so bad, like it's got something like a 60% participation rate, 65% participation rate. We're the worst in the nation at filling in the census and sending it back in, that they might actually lose a House of Representatives member because of how underrepresented Alabama, we've not filling it out. I was a census taker, believe it or not. In 2010, I got a front row seat to the Culture Wars because I was doing the census as a census taker in Marshall County, Alabama, which has a ton of chicken plants. So you had like my area that I was doing was illegal immigrants that work in the chicken plants that did not want to fill out a census form. I can remember going to somebody's house and a dude ran out the back door. Every time I'd show up at some of the trailer parks or some of the houses, they'd leave, they'd scatter, right? And also rednecks that didn't want to fill out the census. And you'd see people with the Confederate flag, window shades, and one guy pulled a gun on me. I mean, it was a lot of stuff that was like, wow, this is, so you had rednecks that didn't want to do it because they didn't want the government to know their business. And you had illegals that didn't want to do it for the same reasons. So it was one of those things where it was probably a lot more people live in Marshall County than is on a census form, because I couldn't attest to the fact that it was really difficult to get people to fill those out, more than it should have been. And now we're in a case where it's 2020. It's exactly 10 years later. People are floating the idea of a civil war. But what's interesting about this, and I want to get into a couple of things that I've noticed that are kind of unique. So people always ask, like, you know, you should talk about the Confederate flag more and stuff like that. And I don't know why I would do that, because it's one of those things where I didn't know, I had never, until I moved to New York, and this is going to sound like I'm making this up, but until I moved to New York, people said the Confederate flag. I had always heard it called the rebel flag. So in my school, in my high school, there were boys that would wear like Confederate flag shirts and belt buckles or boots or whatever, you know. Maybe in their truck, they might have a flag or something, kind of rednecks, kind of trashy, but I'd always heard it called the rebel flag. And they looked at it more as like a don't tread on me symbol, in terms of, you see the don't tread on me shirts where the snakes chopped into 13 pieces or whatever, like a Revolutionary War thing. I think that's almost how they looked at it. I don't think they really understood it as a symbol of racism and oppression. And it's odd, because the majority of the country, they look at the Confederate flag as a symbol of oppression. We're going to own slaves. We're going to buy and sell people. We're going to tell them what to do. And a lot of the rednecks I can remember from my high school, and nobody's saying these guys are the most well-read bunch of people that you've ever met or whatever, but I can remember that they would look at it more as the exact opposite. They looked at it more as a symbol of freedom for themselves against federal government tyranny. The federal government and the snobs in New York and Los Angeles, they look down on them. They're telling them what to do, and it's almost like saying, piss on you. I got my truck. I got my boots. I got, you know, I can do what I want. I don't have to take orders from you. And so it's very interesting that this same group of people has found a champion in Donald J. Trump, of all fucking people. The fact that the Civil War is being floated by this man is, to me, that's incredible. And I want people to really think about how hypocritical this is. When you look at the conservatives, they talk about the liberal media bubble, the liberal media bubble. They exist in a liberal media bubble, almost all of them. When I look at Joe Rogan's podcast and he goes on and on about political correctness, cancel culture, and people trying to tell me what to do, he lives in that bubble because he's a rich fucking guy from a blue state. He doesn't even know these people that are really listening to his stuff, that are his fans, and they all love him. They're like, Joe Rogan, man, he tells it like it is and all this shit. He could not find Alabama on a map. Donald Trump, before he was running for president, he could not have found Alabama on a map until he came to Mobile to do big rallies, and that's where all the people would come. He didn't care about Alabama. He didn't care about people like that, these red states, that big L in the middle of the country that runs from North Dakota to South Carolina and Georgia. People like Rogan and Trump and the Fox News reporters, they look down on people like this. And I know they do. And this was one of the things in the debate that drove me nuts, is when Trump was talking about his education, Joe Biden went to a state school. I went to Wharton. That proves I'm smart, you know, and all this shit. Never mind that his dad, who gave him $400 million, he bought his way into Wharton. He bought his fucking diploma. Same thing for Bush and all those other shitheads. They buy these degrees. Jared Kushner's dad donated a library to Harvard and bought his degree or whatever. But the fact that you can, and this is why I keep going on and on about private schools, is because people buy their way in. The rich kids are treated differently because their parents donate more money. The whole point of them going there is so they can be treated differently. And then when they get out, they're like, I went to a private school, and then I went to an Ivy League school, and their parents are buying their way the whole fucking journey. It's not about how smart they are or what they've earned or anything like that. I couldn't have afforded to go to Harvard University. Doesn't mean that Jared Kushner is a smarter person than I am. It means that he had a parent that could buy his way into the school, could literally donate a fucking library to the school, could then buy a degree, could influence professors because they're heavily influenced by big money parents and donors and things like that. That's what that means. But they look at that status as like a status that's been bought and paid for. They look at that as like earned. And I can vouch for this full hand. That drove me crazy when Trump was like, Joe Biden, he went to Delaware State. I went to Wharton 50 years ago. But Trump's talking about it like he went to an Ivy League school yesterday. 50 years ago, goddamn polio was just about still around. I mean, a science class might have taught that the sun revolves around the earth. You know, that's how long ago this has been. Scientific understanding about climate change didn't exist. People used to think that fat caused heart attacks. Now they know that it's sugar, and the Sugar Research Council put out a bogus report that sugar was good for you, and it was fat that wasn't. So everything went to fat-free, which meant more sugar, which has actually been what's caused the increase in diabetes and heart disease. People's scientific knowledge 50 years ago was a joke compared to today. And in 50 years, my kids will have a better scientific knowledge than I do. This is how it's always been. But the fact that he went to that, the ultimate who gives a shit, like you're the president of the United States. He's the vice president of the United States, or was. And the fact that he's going back to, he went to the wrong school and I went to a good school and all this, I thought that is so typical of like an East Coast snob and how they think. Colin Quinn had an excellent joke in one of his comedy specials about New York is the only place that has blue-collar snobs, and that you can have somebody who's totally a dumbass and uneducated, but they think they're better than everybody just by mere existence of being from New York. So you could take a plumber from Queens and put him in a room with scientists, they'd be like, you know, they're smart, but they're not New York smart. You know what I mean? That is a little true. Like, there is a chip on the shoulder that comes from that upper East Coast echelon. And that's where a lot of conservative media figures, that's where they're all coming from. Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Joe Rogan, Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani. Half the Fox News room comes from that background. Then when you get into things like, I went to Auburn University, which for me is a good school. A lot of people would agree it's a pretty good school. But when I would get to New York, I mean, people who would go to like East Queens Tech or Staten Island State or something. And I'm not trying to put those schools down. If you, whatever college you go to and get a good degree is a good school. Like any college except for maybe a bogus one like Trump University is a good school. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad, but I would go to New York and people would look down on it like, oh, a Southern school. We'd never heard of that or whatever. And it might have been a better school than Fordham University. But there was just that innate snobbery of state schools, particularly ones that weren't from the Northeast. When Trump was saying that at the debate, it was almost brought me a flashback back to, you know, being at a job in New York or something, and they'd be like, what college I went to? And they'd say, oh, that's a real school, or, you know, whatever, that snobbery. Or they'd say, how'd you find out about this job? And I'd be like, the internet. And they'd be like, there's internet in Alabama? Like, that's how they would look at it, almost like it was Afghanistan or something, some remote mountainous region. Where I'm like, yeah, we got indoor plumbing and internet last year, actually. It was a big year for us. I mean, it was so ridiculous that people would have that mentality. But you would find a lot of people in New York that were in a bubble in terms of what they thought the rest of America was like, how bad it was, how uncivilized it was. Oh, you probably don't have IKEA there. Of course we have IKEA or Target or wherever they were really going to buy most of their stuff. And I feel like there was that mentality, and I feel like Trump absolutely has that same mentality because he was born and raised in New York City. He didn't spend a lot of time in the rest of the country unless he was building properties or doing so overseas, and that was only the biggest areas and doing real estate deals and things like that. So he's a total East Coast snob. And some people say, well, the Manhattaners, they look down on Trump because he's from Queens. And you would see that kind of chain going like that. Like in New York, you know, maybe Manhattan people look down on Queens, and then Queens looks down on New Jersey. All of New York looks down on New Jersey, and then New Jersey looks down on Virginia, and then Virginia looks down on North Carolina. North Carolina looks down on South Carolina. South Carolina, Georgia, and Tennessee, they look down on Alabama, you know, and that's where the chain ends. Stops with us, unless we look down on Mississippi, but that's where it would generally end. And so I guess you come from that place, and I've dealt with that quite often, where it would be like people would think, oh, well, you're from Alabama, you must be an idiot. And people would just assume that or know that. And in Minnesota, I dealt with that quite often, where I would be talking to people that were clearly less intelligent than I was. But if I was beating them in a debate, all they would say is like, oh, yeah, I'm from the South. I eat cornbread. You know, like they would put on a fake Southern accent or make fun of the way I talk. And then they would use that to sort of be like, we're smarter than you and we're better than you. And I feel like Trump does do that. And people have released stories that in private, he looks down on his base. Everybody can remember. He said, I love the uneducated at one of his rallies. He goes, I love the uneducated because it's like these people are idiots. These are the ones I can take advantage of. At another one of his rallies, he was like, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it and they'd still support me. And he's tried to prove that correct. One of the big things with the debate that drove me crazy is when he said nobody at any of his rallies had died. I was screaming at the TV, Herman Cain died. You know, I can't believe Biden didn't say anything about that. There was a couple things if I was Biden, I wouldn't have let him go. But I think it was just so exhausting for him to deal with that. And he just was thinking like, wow, I wouldn't let some stuff go because I know how the media is. The media is going to look at that no matter what Biden does. Biden could stand still as a mannequin and not open his mouth for an hour and a half. And Trump just rant and rave and berate. And the media would portray it as both sides had a bad night. Both sides got into it. Both sides acted like children, you know, because there's an inherent, at this point, the conservatives have complained so strongly about liberal media bias. There's a conservative media bias because CNN and the big three networks and a lot of the mainstream reporters, they bend over backwards not to criticize Trump and to portray it as, oh, well, the Democrats and the Republicans, they can't come to a deal on the stimulus. That's the Republicans' fault. But they portray it as, oh, Congress. They just throw out a general term. They'll say, oh, Congress can't reach a deal on this. That's the Republicans' fault. Congressional dysfunction and stagnation. They make that sound like it's both sides' fault. Nancy Pelosi's passed 300 bills in the House. Mitch McConnell won't have a vote on them. He's gone on TV and bragged about obstructing Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi. He's bragged about all the federal judges that he didn't let Obama appoint. And then Trump brings it up at the debate. Joe Biden, we had 128 judges at the federal level that he left vacancies on. I can't believe Democrats would even vote for this guy. As though Mitch McConnell hadn't gone out 3 months ago and bragged about why that was. Mitch McConnell goes on TV and brags about his nickname, the Grim Reaper. He said, they call me the Grim Reaper because of all the bills I kill. The media is like, well, both sides can't get anything done. This is ridiculous. When you absorb that climate and you know that the media is going to portray, you might as well say, you're wrong. Herman Cain died at one of your rallies and pointed out all the COVID cases that have been contracted at some of Trump's rallies. He's going to lie about it, but so what? At least you get your point out there. When Trump goes on about all the federal judges that weren't appointed under Obama, say because McConnell blocked it all, and these are things that I know people say, well, Biden, he didn't want to get involved in every single thing. Sometimes you have to. And so when we get to this point of, is there going to be a second civil war? It would be extremely odd. Donald Trump, New York snob, billionaire, playboy, sex addict from New York. I mean, it's just so odd that who Trump's base is considering who Trump is. Evangelical Christians love a man who is a well-known sex addict that's been married 3 times, had kids with 3 separate women, was a peeping Tom at the Miss Universe pageant, talks about grabbing by the pussy, makes comments about marrying 10-year-old girls, makes comments about fucking his own daughter. Maybe that's the part that they really like is all the young girls and the incest. And they asked him a question about if he'd ever had a girlfriend have an abortion. He said, interesting question. What's your next question? So he wouldn't answer them. A lot of people think Melania was an Eastern Bloc prostitute. Trump clearly has had sex workers, prostitutes, porn stars. Michael Cohen was in jail for paying hush money. I mean, you wouldn't think this would be a man that evangelical Christians would look at and say, hey, that born and bred New York billionaire playboy who culturally doesn't believe any of the same stuff that we do and makes fun of Christians and couldn't name his favorite passage of the Bible, and in fact, couldn't name a passage of the Bible, this is the guy that we need to let carry evangelicalism into the future, right? So you wouldn't think that that culturally would have a lot in common with them. Then you look at the business Republicans. They're like, we love Donald Trump. And I'm like, a guy who bankrupted on two separate casinos, a guy who was forced to dissolve his charity because it was fraudulent, a guy that was at the time running a Ponzi scheme, Trump University, a guy that inherited $400 million and really, if he left it in a 1% CD at the bank, would currently have more money. If he left it in a bank CD paying 2 or 3% interest, he'd have more money than off the money he inherited from his father than anything he's done with it. This man who is considered radioactive by Goldman Sachs, they wouldn't lend him loans, who's $400 million in debt, who had to turn to the presidency to make money, as his tax returns prove. You wouldn't think this would be the guy that business Republicans would look up to even before you get into what he's done as president, which is tariffs and a trade war, and talks about Microsoft. If they buy TikTok, they owe the Treasury a percentage of that deal. Now, that should have scared the fuck out of business Republicans because they don't like stuff like that at all. If they'd been Obama, they'd be talking about, how are we going to poison this guy? You know, that should have scared the shit out of those people. He's tanked the economy. Disastrous coronavirus response is responsible for the economy tanking, unemployment rising, the fact that we're going to have talked about refusing to step down from office even if he loses. That'll make the stock markets tank. So you wouldn't think that business Republicans would necessarily fall in love with this guy either. Then you look at the military conservatives, and Trump says things like, well, the people with guns, they're on my side. I don't know if that's true. I hope it's not true. Might be true. He sucks up to them enough, especially the police. But every general that's worked for him has refused to endorse him. McMaster won't endorse him. John Kelly thinks he's an idiot based on everything that John Kelly has ever said about Trump, both private and what's been leaked. General Mattis wrote an editorial about Trump's disastrous handling of the George Floyd protest. This is General Mad Dog Mattis. If you are to the right on civil rights issues, to a general called Mad Dog Mattis, something's not correct. All these generals, they refuse to endorse him. John Bolton wrote a book about how incompetent Trump is. The majority of the people that are from his administration that have turned on him, Miles Taylor, Olivia Troy, Elizabeth Newman, these are people mostly in the national security establishment. They know that he's dangerous. Dan Coats refuses to endorse him, his former national security director. The majority of Biden's never Trump support, David Frum, Bill Kristol, these are all military conservatives and security hawks and neocons. They're coming from the perspective of Trump has been put in power by Russia, a hostile foreign government, crazy, he's unreliable, he doesn't respect NATO and the United Nations, he doesn't respect America's alliances, he hates our allies, he loves our enemies, he can't be trusted, he didn't do shit once he found out that Russia put a bounty on American troops in Afghanistan, did nothing about it. He trusts Russian intelligence agencies more than his own. He's gone to war with the national security establishment. He hates the FBI, doesn't want to be investigated, doesn't believe in checks and balances. Yeah, these are things that would be concerning to me. Even when you get into the Freedom Caucus, libertarian, small government constitutionalists, these are the people that love Trump the most, and they should hate him more than anybody. A president who doesn't respect checks and balances, who's been impeached for asking hostile foreign governments for help on an election rival, who said he won't step down if he loses the election, who says the election is rigged against him, the incumbent president, with all the power and tools that the incumbent president has at their disposal, who hates the FBI, who doesn't like the concept of checks and balances, and has committed more executive overreach than any president I could think of. So much of the shit he's trying to do, as Miles Taylor, his own Homeland Security deputy, put it, is either illegal or unconstitutional or insane. So you'd think they would hate him more than anybody. To me, it's very odd that this coalition of people known as the Republican Party is so fanatically loyal to this man. And that's what gives me hope that we're not headed for a second civil war. Because the thing about the Civil War you have to understand is it was as much about money as anything else. Slavery is an economic system. At that time, the Southeast had a booming economy off cotton. Cotton was picked by slaves. They didn't want to have to pay people to pick the cotton. They didn't want people to have the freedom to, if you're a slave in the Southeast, then you'd rather go be, you know, factory worker or a sailor or a shipper or move to the Northeast. They didn't want you to have the freedom to do that. They wanted to have a literally captive labor force they knew could do the job and that they would have to pay them absolutely nothing beyond what they needed to survive in terms of food and shelter. that's what they wanted to keep in place because there was a lot of money being made. People forget at that time, the number one export from America was Southern cotton. There was a huge demand for it. In Europe and all over the world, people wanted cotton. They wanted those products. The economics of a civil war at that time, you could look at it as they're protecting not only white supremacy, but an economic system. This time's different because it would only be white supremacy. People say, no, because all the money that white people control, that is an economic system, and they don't want minorities to have access to that. That is true, and I'll give you that. I'll concede that point. But at the same time, look at all the big business people. Look at how much money they would lose if there was a civil war. And this year, we can see a mini version of that playing out. There's rioting in the streets. There's shutdowns in all of America's biggest cities. What kills me is when Trump says stuff like, Biden, if he wins, he's going to keep the economy shut down. What fucking Podunksville? I mean, I know Trump people live in rural areas, but LA and New York and Seattle and Boston, I mean, we've been shut down 8 months straight just about. So I don't know what the hell he's talking about. When he talks about Biden, he's going to keep the shutdown going. What keeps happening is the cities, which is the majority of GDP, we are locked down and we are shut down. And there's a lot of shit you can't do in a big city. But the rural areas are not shut down. Or I think Alabama had like a 3-week shutdown. I think the biggest concession Kay Ivey made to coronavirus was she said, oh, the bars can't be open till 2. They have to close at midnight. Great. Coronavirus shows up late a lot of times. Like between 12 and 3, that's when you get coronavirus. But between 8 p.m. and midnight, probably wouldn't get it then. I mean, that was ridiculous. And now, of course, a lot of the areas that were reopened and everybody was loving, like the beach, they're wiped out from hurricanes. So you have hurricanes and flooding pounding Alabama at the same time. People talk a lot about the West Coast wildfires, and the wildfires definitely are scary, where you've had well over 1 million acres lost. But the Gulf Coast is getting pounded by hurricanes. She reopened these areas that are now closed again, and they've had to evacuate Gulf Shores and Orange Beach and places like that because of how deadly the hurricanes have been. But what keeps happening is the red states, they're allowed to reinfect the big cities because they're not shut down. The whole country has to be shut down at the same time, and it has to be that way to let coronavirus burn itself out and get over it. And it makes sense to do it from January to April, the first quarter, where everything is slower and the economy is not that strong anyway. And Trump, this is exactly what he should have done. January to March, pretend coronavirus isn't happening. And then in March, a lot of the blue states are going to shut down because they finally know how bad it is. While we'll keep the red states open, oh, it's April and it's getting worse and worse. So now we'll shut down a few of the red states in April and then they're going to reopen in May. And then it never is going to end the way that it's going right now. The whole country has to be coordinated at a federal level, which Trump refuses to do because he doesn't want to take responsibility for this. He says it's this governor's fault and that governor's fault and this mayor's fault and that mayor's fault. He keeps going on and on about the difference between the blue cities and the red cities. There are no red cities. There's a handful like Salt Lake City and Tulsa, and that's about it. But the vast majority, he says, well, the vast majority of the country is run by liberal Democrats. If that's the truth, then why are you bashing them all the time? If you know that the staggering, overwhelming majority of American GDP comes from cities, and you know that 90% of cities are run by Democrats, then what the hell are you bashing them for all the time? This is what kills me. Democrats actually control the economy. But the Republicans control the government. The Republicans control the government because of the way that rural areas are favored in the Senate, in the Electoral College. We've talked about this. But at the same time, the Democrats control the actual economy. California and New York and Massachusetts is the vast majority of American GDP is flowing into these tech sectors that are in three states concentrated. Even when you have a red state city like Austin, Texas, that's booming, that's liberal. Everybody says the People's Republic of Austin, that's the most liberal part of Austin. Something like Nashville is pretty democratic in Tennessee. Even when you get to the state level, all of the thriving cities in these red states are under Democratic leadership at the mayor and city council level. They're controlled. So Democrats, between blue cities and blue states, we control the vast majority of American GDP. Probably 2-1 what Republicans control. But they control the government at about 2-1 rate. So it's weird that the party of business and private enterprise and the booming economy, they don't actually control the economy. And they're not actually what's creating the boom, the technology and the tech boom, the tech sectors, the green economy that's coming up. That's what's controlling the boom, while they oversee the dead parts like fossil fuels, government spending that has to go into military defense contractors and things that wouldn't exist unless the government was propping them up. But even though they're the party that's against government and hates government and the liberal Democrats, they're the big government people. They never made a regulation that they don't like. But yet Republicans control the government. They're the party of government because that's where all their power comes from. So you have Republicans controlling the government, even though they hate government, and you have Democrats controlling the economy, even though everybody thinks we're socialist and communist. It makes no sense, and that's why I am skeptical that there would be a civil war. Once they look at New York and California and Massachusetts and Washington, a handful of other states, that's where the economy is in terms of the biggest drivers of the American economy. And then the blue cities trapped inside the red states, that's another big driver of American economy. And you look at what Republicans produced in terms of a red state and a red city, and you've got something like Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Cheyenne, Wyoming, or something like that. And it's almost non-existent in terms of that level. So they may have something like a constitutional crisis. Trump may go out there, he may encourage his lunatic base to, what I think will happen is Trump will lose, and for 75 days, he will try to fight it in the courts, and he'll try to fight it in the streets, where he's encouraging his idiots to go out there and pick up AK-47s and commit violence. And you'll have several dozen, like Cesar Sayoc, that absolutely do that. You might see a Democratic office in a red state blown up. You might see one or two Democratic congressmen killed. You may see a state representative that's liberal. You may see them get killed. You will see some violence in that 75-day period. But at that same time, while he's doing that, the Electoral College and the courts, they're going to look at what he's doing. I hope to hell they look at what he's doing, and they say this is why he cannot be allowed to continue as president. And I think it may create blowback over what he's trying to do. I hope that it does. I hope that's the moment when Republicans are like, we cannot allow this to go forward. And fuck Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell likes that Trump appointed his wife, Elaine Chao, to Secretary of Transportation. But, you know, McConnell and his wife, they can find other jobs because we can't support this at this point. And you've seen a few defectors like Jeff Flake and Lisa Murkowski. You've seen a couple. But if Trump is really doing all this stuff, I don't see how you couldn't have at least 5-10 big Senate Republicans come out. And at that point, the Democrats control the House of Representatives. And if they control the majority in the Senate, you may see something rush through to impeach Trump. At least to the point of, if he's calling for riots in the streets, I can't imagine that just Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski would not go out there and say Trump cannot be allowed to continue. People say, well, yeah, but look at Jellyfish Graham and how he was all against Trump, and now they're butt buddies. And look at all the people that said they were never Trump, and then they go on his side the second he needs them. And that's true, that there is something about his tentacles that are strong. But this is a very different scenario than the last times we've had major conflict. It always seems to come in the 60s. In the 1860s, there was a course, the Civil War, and in the 1960s, there was the end of segregation and the breakup of the Democratic Party and the assassinations that were happening and the riots, the civil rights stuff that was going on. So the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, 1860s and 1960s. What's different now is that it's just Trump. It's not anything organic that's really happening in terms of we need slavery to end and the South doesn't want to because it's an economic system. Or it's the 1960s and it's like we need segregation to end and the South doesn't want to. This is different in that the majority of the country is being divided by the president. It's not bottom up, top down. It's Trump. He's the one dividing us. And for that reason, you can see why the Russians and China and America's enemies have put so much effort into keeping him there and keeping him in place and wanted to elect him in the first place. They saw that this was going to happen. And that's why the biggest thing I'm worried about is that 75-day period between the election and the inauguration. What's China going to do? And what's Russia going to do? They look for opportunities like that. They may very well do something bad. They could shut off power to the West Coast, just for one example. And it may look wildfire related, but it may not. It may be hacking Pacific Power Grid. Something along those lines. A hack of the stock market index. A hack of the nuclear power plant. Something while everybody's divided and Trump is dividing everybody and the military generals are literally saying, who are we going to back? The president of the United States or the guy who actually won? While the country is that divided and that at each other's throats, that's the perfect time for them to do something really bad. I would predict a cyber attack, but we've already seen coronavirus. We've seen the damage that a biological attack could do. That would be my biggest fear, is that we would be open to something like that while we are that divided and that at each other's throats. But we only have one person to blame for that. And ultimately, whether we go to a civil war, whether it's a constitutional crisis that's brief and Trump is drug out of the White House, that really depends on what Republicans do. Republican senators, Republican governors, and Republican generals that are currently in the White House and in the national security establishment. What do they do? And that really determines if we have a brief constitutional crisis with a lunatic president who's thrown out of office and then possibly in a loony bin, or the Handmaid's Tale. And it's scary to think about it. I've often said that I think Trump will not go to jail if he leaves power quietly and just leaves and disappears and then allows Republicans to be like, oh, wow, if only we had a second Trump term, what could have been? And oh, the nostalgia for that. But that's if he leaves. If he tries to create a civil war and he calls for violence and some of his fans take him up on it, he may very well go to jail. Because at that point, you have to set an example so that Matt Gaetz can't do the same shit in 10, 15 years. And also, Trump's the kind of guy he could defect. He could defect to Russia and take all of America's secrets with him. Or even if neither one of those things happens, you still have him out there in the streets every day trying to gather up his supporters, being like, oh, every time anything goes wrong for Biden, he's out there being like, now's our chance. Now we should go and launch a coup and do that. I think the deal has to be with Trump and his kids, and possibly his kids have to talk to him and say, none of you go to jail if you fucking leave. That's the deal. You're not president anymore, but you leave and you shut up and you don't call for civil war every day. That may be the ultimate bargain. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay tuned for episode 76 coming up shortly.